Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Code Zoo Vine for August 31st, 2013, Labor Day weekend. Happy Labor Day, everybody. I'm your host, David McLaughlin. Joining me as always, welcome Tim Shiflett.
Good evening, sir.
And returning from Noonan, welcome Catherine Smith.
Here I am in Atlanta.
Yes. Well, we got a big weekend this weekend in Georgia politics and really a big week in Southern politics in general. So we just have a ton of topics. Didn't have a guest because I look at all the topics and just thought, well, let's not go there. But first thing, I got to share a story that is so fresh on my mind because I just saw it about an hour and 20 minutes ago. I come out of a shopping establishment in Rome, Georgia, and there was a car running. Now you start thinking, who in the world would leave a car running? Because no one's in the car. Because I wanted to look in to see if anybody's in the car. I thought, man, these people are either crazy or drunk. And so I look in the front seat, and there's about a half-drunk bottle of Wild Turkey and a Solo cup that looks like it has a little something mixed in with the Wild Turkey. But I have never seen a parked car running with nobody in sight. And then when you look in, it has obviously somebody drinking alcohol. You're thinking, the police might stop and look at this car, and then you see it here. I almost wanted to wait around and see what exactly got in this car, but then I wouldn't want to be on the road with it. But I just had to share that crazy story. Have y'all ever seen anything like that around?
No, but I would have called the cops if it was me.
That might not have been a terrible suggestion. Maybe you're a better Samaritan than I am. Tim?
Well, at the risk of self-incrimination with stories from my younger days, I think I'll just pass on this one, David, if you don't mind. You know what I mean, buddy?
I thought Tim was going to say, now, what kind of car was it? Where were you shopping? I might have been there. Well, let's get into politics. And maybe the reason this person had, been partaking of the Wild Turkey and forgot to leave their car running is they had been in Noonan yesterday, and that's just where it drove you. Anyway, they got an election done, and it took two ballots. Catherine, I could talk about what I read on the blogosphere, but you were there, so I'm going to defer to you.
Okay, well, not only was I there, but I was also on the election committee, so I guess I had a up-close and personal experience, you might say. Well, I arrived early to make sure that everything was under control, and we had a great crowd, 250 people, which is a record for state committee meetings of late. So everyone was very pleased about that because there was a lot of concern about meeting quorum because it was, it's Labor Day weekend, and it was, some people were concerned about the location, but it turned out fine, and the location was wonderful. The auditorium was jam-packed full. We had a lot of guests. We had media guests and, supporters there. Thankfully, a couple days prior to the election, the three candidates agreed to limit campaign materials, to buttons, T-shirts, and stickers. So we didn't have a lot of things being passed out. We didn't have signs. We didn't have all the sort of extraneous stuff that sometimes causes trouble in the audience. So that was a relief. I was glad about that. But the registration opened at 11:30. The meeting started promptly at 1. I mean, I think we started at maybe 5 minutes after 1. We had a few stragglers coming in after time, but we started right away into speeches and nominating and everything. And by 2:45, we were ready to start voting, which is really good. I mean, it might not even been that late. It might have been more. No, it was like 2 o'clock. We were ready to begin voting. And I was in the basement sorting the ballots to make sure that we had the proper number of ballots for each congressional district. And we went upstairs with the ballots, and there was a little interruption. There are some new members of the executive committee and the party that are not familiar with our general processes. And the question came up that we should, that according to our charter and bylaws, we require a roll call vote. And someone, and I'm honestly not sure exactly who actually brought it to the attention of the body, but someone called for a roll call vote in the audience so that everyone had to stand up and say who they were voting for within the body, which is very contrary to the way we've ever done anything. We've always done it with signed, with ballots with the name signed and printed in their congressional district. So the crowd just erupted, and, you know, boos and screaming and hollering. And so there was about a 40-minute break in the meeting and the discussion, both a public discussion with the audience and then a huddle with the candidates and the executive committee. Well, not the executive committee, but the officers. And originally it was decided that, yes, we would do a roll call vote, and then that announcement went over like a brick, and everybody was yelling and screaming. So the candidates agreed that the printed ballot with the signature would suffice, would serve as a roll call vote, so we proceeded as we always would after a 40-minute break. So then we voted. Everyone voted, and there were 250 qualified voters and former House leader and governor candidate DuBose Porter got 125 votes. The requirement is 50% plus one. So we're up by one vote. And so we had to re-vote with RJ out of it because he got the least amount of votes. And then it was quick. We tried to turn it around very quickly, and so we were quickly able to announce that DuBose Porter is the new chair of the Democratic Party of Georgia.
Yeah, I noticed that, well, first thing on the roll call vote, I would have been groaning just because the roll call vote would have taken longer, but then when I heard we had to have a 40-minute discussion over whether or not to have a roll call vote, I would have groaned again. Because, you know, me, since I host my own podcast, I'm never afraid to tell where I stand on something, so I really don't care if people know how I feel. But then just the time-consuming nature of a roll call vote would have been no fun. But let me ask you this. I saw that when they had the second ballot, Doug Stoner, who was the second vote, leading vote getter, he actually dropped in support. Basically, it looked like DuBose Porter retained every single vote he had and added every single one of R.J. Hadley's voters and then got a few of Doug Stoner's voters. What was the momentum like? You may not have been – you may have been counting votes. You may not have been on the floor, but – What you heard? What was the what caused that?
Well, I don't know. I wasn't on the floor, so I wasn't. I'm not sure what caused any of the. You know, a lot of times, it's just people just change their mind. Whether you know, for whatever reason, they might not be particularly compassionate about a vote. They just say, "Oh, I'm going to vote for Doug Stoner," and then the next time they go, "Oh, well, you know, I kind of like to vote. I'm going to vote for him." I don't know. But it could be not very many people left, but there were about I think we were missing 12 people. So those could have been supporters of Doug Stoner's, for all I know, because we went from 250 to 238, I think, which is amazing. I mean, the whole thing was amazing that on Labor Day weekend we had that many people and that many people stayed, because oftentimes after the first vote half the crowd leaves. And then we often have a question about quorum after that. So that was really remarkable. And I applaud everyone. And, you know, honestly, the crowd was – everyone was really well-behaved. There was very little impatience until this question came up about the voting. And I think that I'll just say, like, personally, as Catherine Smith, not as the elections committee, I would have been very I think it would have been very disturbing to have to do the roll call vote, because there was a lot of brouhaha around this election. There were there was a lot of strong arming, and I think that it would have been very uncomfortable for some people to stand up and vote their mind publicly like that. So I'm really glad that that did not prevail. I think it would have put a real damper on the election. I think a lot of people felt like it was voter suppression or voter intimidation. So I'm really glad that it did not prevail.
Yes. Well, of course, I've got more questions and comments, but I'm going to pass it to Tim for a minute to let him have his say.
Catherine, the question I got, I know before, because you were on the elections committee, that you weren't really able to give us your sense of where you thought this thing was going to go. Now that it's over and in looking back, was there really any surprise in your mind at the final result?
I got to tell you, I thought it was going to be a little closer than it was. I was pretty confident that DuBose-Porter was going to prevail, but I thought it would be a much tighter race.
Uh-huh.
I mean, obviously it was tight because he didn't get the – but he won both ballots. He just didn't win by enough in the first one.
Uh-huh.
But I did think it was going to be a little tighter. I actually thought that the first ballot was going to be split about three ways. I thought
mm-hmm.
RJ had more support than he did,
mm-hmm.
and I thought that DuBose might have had a little less than he did. So I thought we were going to be much closer in that first ballot.
Why do you think it turned out then that way? Why was he so strong?
I think that he did a really good job of talking to people, and I think he has a lot of respect in the rural communities that have known him for so long. And I think he's just very personable and very, very authentic and approachable. And I'm not saying that Doug Stoner isn't a nice guy. He's a nice guy. And I think that either one of them would have been really good. I think that RJ would have been a good chair, but I think I've said this before, I don't think it was the best time for him. I think that there's going to be a time for him later when he'll be able to prevail in an election like this. But I think right now it wasn't quite time for him. And I have a great deal of admiration for RJ, more than I can really express. But I think that Senator Stoner used a strategy that is not new, of getting sort of big name endorsements,
mm-hmm.
and I think some of our state committee members don't really like that. You know, they
mm-hmm.
don't really care if I don't want to say they don't really care, but it doesn't really move them to see big names, big Democratic names that aren't involved in the party so much.
Mm-hmm.
Or involved in the state committee part of the party. I don't think that those have the same impact as their neighbors or their you know, other state committee colleagues. So I think that played into it too.
You know, that's interesting, because I can remember a time years ago when getting those big names to support you, particularly a governor or somebody, was just everything. But that really is no longer the case then, huh?
Well, that's just my impression. I can't say. I mean, there was a lot of – I heard a lot of people talking about Mayor Kasim Reed was there yesterday, and he was a big supporter of Doug Stoner.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a lot of people from outside of Atlanta – who were like, "What? You know, he's not my mayor. Why should I?
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't have any power over me." And
mm-hmm.
I have a lot of respect for the mayor, and I was really glad that he showed up yesterday. I thought it was very kind, and he stayed through the bitter end, and you know, good for him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's always good if you strongly believe in supporting a candidate to show up and do it. I got nothing against that.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that some people felt like there was, you know, pressure from someone like Mayor Reed, or Governor Barnes came out in big support of Doug Stoner as well, though he did not show up. He was not there yesterday to vote or to support him. So I don't know what that means. But mm-hmm. it may not mean anything. So I think that was part of it. I think that some of the people from outside of Metro Atlanta were sort of like, well, you know, why does it matter who the mayor of Atlanta supports? But you know, we always have that problem with Metro Atlanta and rural. You know, there's always some.
Yeah.
And I think that that's one of the things that DuBose was good at, is that he does well in Metro Atlanta with the city people, and then he also has a big following and a lot of support in rural Georgia. So I wish him all the best, and I'm here to help him. And I think everybody, I think we came away yesterday very unified. I was very happy that so many people showed up, and especially that they stayed. And I think there was a real sense of momentum in the room. So, you know, onward and upward, forward for Georgia.
There we go.
I have to give incredible kudos to Nakima Williams for, you know, taking the realm of this, the temporary realm of the party, and doing a fantastic job. She was wonderful yesterday and has been so hardworking and supportive of the party, you know, all along, but even more so these last 2 months or so. So, you know, congratulations to her for, you know, holding the helm for this period. It was a very important volunteer task for which she had to leave her job.
Yeah, and DuBose has some major work cut out for him, and I can't speak for all local parties, but I can speak for this one because our bylaws say that I can. And you know, if we stand ready to assist the new state party chair in any way he feels he needs us, then we certainly wish him the best, and we want to help him in any way we can. So David, jump back in there, buddy.
Yeah, that would be a strange set of bylaws if you couldn't support the new elected leader of the DPG.
Well,
I mean,
actually,
not a week ago, it'd be controversial. But
what I meant, David, was that the bylaws state that I am the official spokesperson for the party up here on public matters.
Oh, now we're in real trouble, because think all the crazy things he says, Catherine, on all these topics.
What'd you just go on?
Well, it sounds like a good election. It's time to move on, because obviously I think all three of these candidates would have been superior to what Chairman Berline had become at the end. I'll be nice and not say what he may have been at this point, but towards the end when it became defend one guy at all costs, and then, of course, his own legal issues. This is a much better place for the party to be. More exciting news that came out of, I guess, the weekend is the Democratic Party now has a candidate for governor, and she is a former state senator, ran for Congress. She's actually been a client in the past. I did her state's Senate site. I did her our campaign site for Congress, but it's been a good many years since I worked with her, so I had no idea this was going to happen, but she's Connie Stokes is going to run for governor. Now, I don't think Connie Stokes is an A-level candidate you typically get, but given that Nathan Deal is an incumbent Republican with a lot of, you know, popularity and high approval rating in his own party, and we'll get to that, his own party part in a second, this is a pretty good candidate, I think. I mean, it's somebody credible that can point to a record of public service, and I really didn't know that we would honestly do this well in getting a candidate. Now, obviously, the big question will be is how much money can she raise, and that'll be remain to be seen. But, Catherine, once again, I'm going to come to you first. You were down there. How was she received?
Well, I was in the basement when she made her announcement.
Okay.
So I didn't hear it. But I'm excited. I've been saying for the last couple of weeks that I think it would be really great if we had an all-women slate for all the constitutional officers. So we're ticking away. We've got three now. Well, we've got Michelle Nunn and then Connie Stokes and Alicia Thomas Morgan running for state school superintendent. So a few more to tick off, and we'll have a well-rounded slate.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's and you know, that's fine to me if it's all female. Now, I think Simple might say, hey, you need a little diversity with at least, you know, one dude in there.
We'll,
given all
we'll
the,
tell that
the
to the Republicans.
Offices. Oh,
yeah,
I know,
really.
I mean, and given Georgia's history, that's why I don't mind it as much, because, I mean, it's so many years, it's all males on both sides. So, and then, of course, main thing is somebody that can win. I did not know that Alicia Thomas Morgan was had announced for state school superintendent.
I'm quite sure she announced.
Background, yeah, I'm not quite as excited about that, because I'm actually interested in a public school person that's for public schools, not privatization of schools.
I know. I am with you on that. I will say that I am a fan of Alicia Thomas Morgan in every way except her stance on schools, but.
Which is what matters in this race. If she was running
exactly,
for
you know, no,
I
you're exactly right, David. I am 100% in support of what you're saying. But she has announced.
I mean, that'd be like if you're a Democrat and you're like, I support Democratic policies on everything except Obamacare, and I'm running for insurance commissioner. Problem. You know, I mean, we can go on down the line. I mean, it's like the one big issue that matters in that spot if you're a Democrat. So that's kind of. Unusual, and that will be an open seat. So that'll also be
right.
Interesting to look at. Well, Tim, what's your thoughts on Connie Stokes and her campaign?
Well, I'm actually rather delighted that we got that strong of a candidate. She's not an A-list candidate or a top-tier candidate by any stretch of the imagination, simply because of the fact that she's probably broke. But as you said, she does have a record of public service to run on, so she's at least a second-tier candidate. What is it our mutual friend David Neer calls unheard-of people? Some dude. She's not a some dude type of candidate. She's not going to be a joke. She's not going to be an embarrassment to the party. She will be a credible candidate. I don't know how far that'll get her, like I said, without money, you know, that it probably won't get her very far. But I'm delighted, and maybe this opens the door for a few more candidates who suddenly and curiously see Nathan Deal as more vulnerable than perhaps any of us on this show thought he might be.
Yeah,
or
yeah,
at
we'll
least
get
I thought he might be. So that's where I am with her.
Yeah, we'll get to that. Now, here's the trick about being the Democratic candidate in Georgia, frankly, Alabama, Mississippi, South Carolina, maybe South Carolina's a little better, you know, name a lot of other southern states, Louisiana, is you can get the Democratic nomination, and it doesn't matter if it's any of the three of us. It doesn't matter if you have two nickels to rub together. You're probably going to get 40% of the vote. I mean, so you can always say, hey, I was the Democratic nominee in 2014. I got, you know, 40% of the vote. It was a million-something votes, whatever it is, and I'm going to be proud on that. But then the trick is you can take that same candidate. You could put $10, $15 million in the bank for them. You could give them, you know, President Obama and President Clinton's campaign staff as a dream team. And you might get 45% of the vote. It's that 45-50 that's so hard to get. You know, I mean, you can run a good campaign, and you can get to 45, and that's swell and good. But and you could run just a non-existent campaign and run 40. So what's that secret? Is the you know, the how many of a million dollar question? Any answers?
Yeah. For one thing, you need that $1 million. That you just mentioned.
Several.
That's part of the million-dollar question. Now, secondly, you need all the stars to line up just right. You obviously need a bloodbath on the underside for the nomination. You need a miracle or two, as our friend Joe Prince mentioned to Michelle Nunn. You need just everything to line up perfectly. It wouldn't hurt to have the president and Bill or Hillary Clinton down here doing a little campaign swing with you. And if they felt there was at least a reasonable chance of pulling it off, you know what? I think they'd be right on down here. So you need all of those things. But the first thing you've got to have is the ability to raise money to raise yourself at least to the status of a frontier candidate. Because without that money, you're just not going to get that message out, and you're going to be stuck at that 40%. But, you know, it's important, guys, that we keep running good, decent candidates. Because one of these years, we're going to break through. And I think it's going to be something like a governor or U.S. senator's race long before it's going to be the state legislature, don't y'all?
Yes.
Yeah, I think it's going to be at the top in a big race, maybe some down-ballot race. But then, of course, I don't think that the end goal of the DPG is like one day we'll win insurance commissioner. I mean, that'd be nice. I mean, if that's all we won this time, it'd be better than what we got today. And, you
know,
I'm talking about Texas incremental progress.
Yeah, but David, what if Michelle Nunn wins and by some quirk she actually has some coattails? That could change everything, couldn't it?
And carry something. Yeah, I mean, we know incumbents are big, you know, as far as, you know, incumbency will help because the folks that are just going to continue to run for their office, like we assume Casey Cagle will, and maybe the insurance commissioner, I mean, sorry, labor commissioner and all that, they should be good. It's going to be that open seat. And so, you know, we shall see. Well, Catherine, we've talked about the, you know, Connie Stokes. What about that question of how do you get from 45 to 50?
Well, I think that, you know, I think all the things that you've said are really important. I also think it's going to be really important to, and I know that you and I sometimes disagree about this, but I think it's important to distinguish yourself from the Republicans and speak on, you know, important Democratic values. That doesn't have to be all the, you know, hot button ones, but, you know, whether it's jobs and, you know, equal pay and, you know, those kind of things, whatever you think are the important issues to Democrats. But I think we need to distinguish ourselves more than we sometimes have in the past. That we're not, you know, we're not, I just think we need to distinguish ourselves from the Republicans running. And I think sometimes we tend to react to them rather than stand up for the values that we believe in. So I think that's an important thing. But I also think that what you're saying about being prepared if something happens is so important. It's so important for us to have, you know, good candidates running so that if there's a huge scandal or, you know, some kind of implosion within the Republican Party, that we're ready with good candidates, with good messages, when something like that happens, when we have those opportunities appear, I think we really need to be prepared for that. And for that reason, we also need to, while we may not think that we're going to win the legislature back right away, we still need to be building a bench of people who can run and then ultimately run for higher office and, you know, have people lined up that are qualified and capable and willing to, you know, reach beyond where their current positions.
Oh, yeah, and I think that's, like I said, the Texas model that they've talked about to us, the different people from Burn Orange Report. It's sometimes winning those underneath races and making progress, you know, five legislators at a time every cycle and then be able to hold that even through the, you know, the bad raw deals and redistricting. Well, we've talked about Georgia about half the show, we still got to talk about Georgia, but let's try to be efficient. John Barge, the current state school superintendent, I think shocked me a little bit. I know the rumors said he was looking at running, but I kind of thought he would come to his senses and see that this wasn't a good move, but sure enough, he didn't, and he's going to run for
governor. Now, you know, we can all wish him the best because I think a lot of Democrats probably see him as superior to Nathan Deal. But that's probably going to be his downfall because if we like him better than Nathan Deal, the rank-and-file Republican won't. And so I think he's pretty much going to be a one-term state school superintendent that, you know, loses in the primary of the Republican Party. I even told y'all in an email, I don't think he and David Pennington, the mayor of Dalton, will combine for 50%. I think Nathan Deal will win outright, which will make him be, you know, seem more popular than he may be. Tim, what's your prediction on that?
Yeah, I agree exactly with you. I'm afraid that the superintendent might be driven a little bit here by his intense personal dislike of the governor. Those two people do not like each other, and it might be clouding his judgment a little bit because, as I alluded to a little earlier, some people, especially in the other party, are getting the sense that Governor Deal is a little bit more vulnerable than I think he is. Now, that would make sense if Barge was a Tea Party type candidate, but he's not. He's to the left of the governor, especially on issues like education, way to the left of him. So I don't know where he's coming from here unless he thinks his strong presence in the metro area is going to help him in counties like Cobb and stuff like that. But I don't say that's going to happen. The only way I see that Governor Deal is held under 50%, if there's about four or five more Republicans and a couple of them decent, credible candidates that jump in the race and pull a few percentage points away from him. But right now, with the way it's set up, I don't understand why either one of them's running against him, to be honest with you. You run for one reason, no matter what anybody says. First and foremost, you run to win. Well, you know, if you don't see that outlet other than lightning striking, then what logical reason do you have to run, right, Kathleen?
Well, I agree with you, but I will say that here's what I think. I don't understand why Barge and Pennington didn't try to get together and have one of them run for lieutenant governor and one of them run for governor.
That's a good idea.
Because then they would have had, you know, two voices. Because I think they both seem to be more moderate than either Governor Deal or Lieutenant Governor Cagle, right? I mean, they're both a little bit more moderate. And they might have been a good team working the state with a similar message. I mean, but the other thing is, we don't know if either of them has some secret weapon. And, I agree that you run to win, but sometimes you run to, you know, get a new message out, and maybe they both – I do think it's crazy that both of them are running for governor. I think it's like, you know, if it – I don't know. I just think it's – if I were the second one to go in, I would be like, well, you know, I really wanted to run, but now that this guy's running, I should probably just sit this out because it's not going to help. I mean, if you have a different message that you want to give, no one's going to hear it if you've got three candidates running or two candidates running against an incumbent. But it would have been nice if they'd run as lieutenant governor and governor.
David,
but, you know, they never asked me. I don't know why they don't ask me, but they
never
asked me.
Well, if they'd asked me, they'd have gotten me. It would have been a little different.
Well, David, look.
You know,
David,
go ahead, Tim.
I wanted to ask you this question. Don't you think Barge really is doing this because it is Deal? He could wait his turn and move up. He doesn't want to do that. He wants Nathan Deal. That's what this is about, isn't it?
And I think that's some Pennington, too. And I don't know why he elicits such anger. I mean, maybe I've just been around too long, but I guess Sonny Perdue made me a little more angry than Nathan Deal. To me, Nathan Deal just seems business as usual. I don't like the business, but I think, you know, Glenn Richardson and folks like that are a bigger problem than Nathan Deal even. So I guess he just doesn't, you know, like in wrestling, there's a good heel, and me being a Democrat, the Republican's supposed to be the heel. You know, Nathan Deal just doesn't make that great a heel to me, so I just don't get all lathered up like I would at others. But let me tell you this. I understand in some ways maybe David Pennington. One, he, like Catherine said, he was the first one, so that makes sense. You beat our belts to the punch, so you're going to run. Also, he's the mayor of Dalton. I don't know what the rules of Dalton are, but I figure there's a good chance he can remain mayor of Dalton. Whatever he's going to do for Dalton, he can continue to do, win, lose, or draw. Raises his profile. But John Barge is giving up something of value. I mean, if you want to help Georgia's children, you can actually affect change in that office. You can help with writing curriculums. You can help with putting in new programs that are either better educationally or save money that can then be used for something else. And honestly, John Barge has done some of that. I've seen some of the, you know, the software that they're giving out to systems now. They're giving out at the state level, and that means local systems aren't having to buy it. And so, I mean, I think Democrat or Republican, you're thinking that's pretty good. So he's giving up the ability to do that for what I think is going to be a Pyrrhic, you know, battle that the odds are he's likely to lose. And he had the benefit of those public polls. And, you know, even if he had just a little bit of money in his campaign coffers, he could have commissioned his own poll. And maybe he did. And maybe that poll says something totally different than the public ones. But it seems like you would have said, hey, if you want to be governor one day, wait your turn. It can happen. And I really still think the way to have done that would have been through the Democratic Party, switch parties. I mean, if, you know, education is going to be your big drive and you believe in public education, that's not a huge jump. I know there may be other issues like, you know, abortion or gun rights that may not fit with him and the Democratic Party. But on that biggie for him, it's not a far jump.
Yeah, but he's betting his entire political career on what he's doing now. And I don't see the logic in it. Do you?
I don't either. I mean, I think we've continued to say we don't see the logic. And so it'll be interesting to see it. But it'd kind of be, you know, like watching a car accident for these two gentlemen. I mean, they probably are better gentlemen than Governor Deal. And we'd pick them. But that's the problem. Like I keep saying, if we like them and you're Republican, we ain't going to go real far. And it got, you know, how many times have we said that? A dozen times over the course of this show? You know,
yeah.
If you're our favorite Republican, that's a kiss to death. So it's just something to watch. Well, let's go ahead and cover some other topics. And one I got to get to because, you know, it's my one of my new favorite topics. George Bush, new paintings have come out. And I must say, I saw the cat. I know one's a cat painting. I think another's a dog painting. And I tell you what, he's getting better. There's just no doubt about it. The man is getting better at painting. If you look at the early work, the last couple photos, draw yourself. Am I crazy? He's getting better at painting, isn't he?
He's getting better at painting.
Yeah, Catherine agrees. He's getting better at painting.
He's getting better, but he's not inspired.
Better.
But look, alcohol's got to be involved here somewhere, right?
Are you claiming he had the wild turkey? Is that what you're saying?
I don't know, or maybe you did. No, I'm kidding. I know you don't drink at all. As a matter of fact,
no.
I can say that publicly. But you know the funny thing about this is, those paintings are going to be worth something because a president painted them. It don't matter how great they are. They are going to be worth something. Is he as good an artist as, say, Frank Sinatra was? No, he's not. Sinatra was actually pretty talented, if you've ever seen any of his work. I think the president's just doing it as an outlet, and I guess that's okay. But at least it's getting good enough now that I don't think it's going to be the subject of as much ridicule as it was when y'all were.
Oh, I don't know that it's ridicule. I think it's fascination. The thing I thought is, I was like, man, if he could have just shown as much progress in his ability to be president as he has at painting.
He went the other way on that. Yeah. He dropped off the ledge on that one. He went the other way. So
I mean, he might have woken up one day and said, "Hey, maybe Iraq didn't attack us. Let's not do this war. You know, let's take Afghanistan, who's harboring the terrorists." You know, crazy things like that. You know, it's my fault.
Well, here's what I think. I think, you know, you can become a good painter with enough experience. With practice comes, you know, you paint enough with and he's got a good teacher, it sounds like. So, but I don't see any inspiration in his painting. You know,
yeah,
I don't see any.
You don't
practice to be inspired though. Inspiration has to come from somewhere else.
And
I don't see that. It looks very flat to me. It's the skill is improving, but the otherworldliness of great painting is not there.
Yeah, maybe that's what we're going to get next. I mean, we're going to be looking at his painting, and we're going to be having to try to figure them out. I mean, the cat is really not, you know, deep in introspection. Maybe that's what the bathtub photo was. Now, there might have been more to that one, Cat. His toes in the bathtub. There was something more there.
Yeah. Well, I could only. I knew I could not unsee that, so I only looked at it very briefly.
There were bubbles. There were bubbles. There needed to be bubbles. You know.
Oh God.
We ain't gone there.
Okay, that's enough of that.
Let's move on to some other hardcore politics, if you will. We can report that Kane, the wrestler, will not seek any office. Apparently he's going to film a movie while he recovers, and so he's not going to face Lamar Alexander or anyone else. So I think Lamar Alexander may dodge a bullet here since he's so unpopular. He'll definitely dodge some pain, not wrestling. I'm not wrestling, not running for office. We've covered that. So if Lamar Alexander gets a more quality candidate, we'll bring that up. Now, talking about races we didn't expect to be any good, when Jay Rockefeller said he wasn't going to run for West Virginia Senate, I think a lot of insiders just plugged that in as a automatic Republican take. And now a poll came out showing Shelley Capito, the Republican candidate, with a small lead, under 50%, on Natalie Tennant, who's an elected official there in West Virginia. Now, of course, this is another female Southern Democrat that's doing well, but now she's facing a female Republican. Catherine, what does this mean if Natalie Tennant runs and can be competitive? That's one more place the Democrats have an option now, right?
Yes. I think it's great news.
Yeah. Tim, what's your thoughts on
that? She could obviously make it a close race if she decides to run, which she has not. A 5-point deficit is not that bad. Now, I must qualify this by saying that this particular poll has been attacked by some Republicans as skewed too favorably toward the Democrats. For instance, they say that too many college-age students were interviewed for this poll, whatever that means, and that perhaps it shows the Democratic candidate in a better light than she is actually in. And again, let's go to that 40 to 45 to 50 rule that you talked about a while ago. She sets at 40. We can see her getting to 45. How does she get to 50? Is that 40% she's getting in that 5-point deficit in the initial polling name recognition? Because she also is pretty well known in that state up there. See, all that remains
that
to be
question.
Seen.
I'll go for that question. The reason that 45 is different for her is Joe Manchin, one governor, then one Senate. Earl Ray Tomlin has succeeded him as governor as a Democrat. Democrats have been winning. I mean, that, to me, that's a huge difference. Plus, Joe Manchin and Earl Ray Tomlin can help her because and they're in power. They're not, you know, retreads from the past like a lot of states have to pull out. I mean,
yeah,
those
now.
Have to be there.
And for
some reason, the president is less popular in West Virginia than he is in some other southern states like Georgia and
right.
South Carolina. But folks in West Virginia somehow are still voting a little different locally or statewide than they are on the presidential level. And so for good or bad, and for good if you're just a West Virginian, if you will, and just look at that piece of the puzzle, they can still win. It's a different – now, it may be if it keeps going the way it is in other parts of the South. 10 years ago, those might be the good old days. Joe Manchin may be out of the Senate. Earl Ray Tomlin may have lost re-election.
You don't think in the past, oh, 3 or 4 years, that state has taken a hard enough tack to the right that perhaps she can't realize that 50% now that maybe they're more like Georgia than they were?
I think that state has a lot more white Democratic voters or white swing voters that are less interested in voting for an African American for president than other states are. And I guess more or less they're recognizing black voters in West Virginia. But then those folks have not left the Democratic Party, you know, on the state level for whatever reason. And like I said, everything I said was not good, but at the end of the day, a Joe Manchin and Earl Ray Tomlin can win, so why can't Natalie Bennett?
So it's more like, say, Kentucky than it would be like Georgia. Is that what you're saying?
Bingo. And Steve Beshear is the governor there, and he's a Democrat. And, of course, Allison London Grimes, or Grimes London, she's running real well against Mitch McConnell, a multi-term incumbent. So, you know, it's much more like Kentucky than it is, say, Georgia or South Carolina.
I'll see that point to you.
Well, I mean, it's just,
you're right. Yeah.
Then it's a different story.
Yep.
I mean,
listen to me say you're right, David. I don't say it much.
I say what? Hard audience tonight. Let's try to move on to something else on that one. Talking about candidates that do well in their state but not at the national level, Rick Perry is visiting Iowa again. I guess there's somebody pledges and says, "Thank you, sir. May I have another?" Is that what Rick Perry's doing here, Catherine? Trying to run again for office after the last time went so miserably bad.
I guess he's just a glutton for punishment, or he may be surrounded by people that, you know, want him to run, and so they just keep saying how great he is, and he should try again, and so he listens to that and has a disjointed memory of how bad it went before.
Yeah, Catherine, I think that's a good theory. There's a book by Tony Kornheiser that writes sports, and he published a book of his columns, and he named it "I'm Back for More Cash," because essentially he was just republishing his work in a book form, and so he was like, you know, I really didn't work for this, and it was kind of funny the way he did it. But these folks may just be saying, hey, he can pay us to poll and to produce commercials and whatnot, and we can get paid no matter how bad he does. Tim, your thoughts on Rick Perry and this quixotic race?
Is there any even small chance that this guy is entertaining thoughts of redemption because of the just disastrous race that he ran before? I'll show these people that I'm better than this. I'll show them I know how to run and win. That sort of thinking?
Maybe. I mean, I guess if they hold elections, they will come, and these jokers are showing up to run, no matter how poorly they did.
Maybe he's thinking about it like the SATs. Like, I've studied for the last 4 years, and now I'll try again.
Well, what else would he do? What else would he do? On the other hand, I think they're weary of electing him governor in Texas. I think that's about to play itself out. So maybe he's just thinking, well, you know, why not? What else will I do? Right?
Start some kind of foundation in Texas and retire and, you know, do it old politics.
That's
too.
Not the kind he is. That's not
he hasn't studied that hard, David.
Yeah.
I know. He could have to make all the work. These characters that want to make money off of him can just do all the work.
And he saw a guy from his own state who he would, not publicly, but probably privately, say, you know what, I'm as talented as he was, and he became president. And he would have a point there. So, you know, it might be that.
That's true. Well, let's continue to cover topics now. America's had a long tradition of, way back when, of folks handing out whiskey and getting folks to vote. In Tuscaloosa, Alabama, they had sororities that had this going on, if you will. Tim, tell us more about this story.
Well, apparently, for some, you know, it wasn't no big elections. It was like council elections.
It was school board, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, I think it was on the school board was one of them, and maybe like the town council was another one. And apparently members of a local sorority there were offered rides to the polls in limos and free drinks at a local watering hole in exchange for their votes. Well, you know, offering rides to the polls has been a time-honored thing. We've done that here. I remember when my father did it in the sheriff's races when I was a little kid, and that's been going on forever. Personally, I don't see anything wrong with it, although I do wonder why somebody running for such a small potato seat would hire limos to do it when local volunteers with their Corvairs would be just as good. Now, the buying liquor in local watering holes, man, we're bordering on like buying somebody's vote through bribery, or at least I think so. And I'm not going to say I haven't seen political liquor passed out. I most certainly have. Anybody that's been around politics a long time, especially in some of these rural counties, has seen that. And again, I'll go no further for reasons of self-incrimination. But it really looks bad. No matter if they broke a law or not, it really, really looks bad. On that story, the link you sent us, there was a picture of those limos set. Now, it just didn't look right, did it?
No, Catherine, you know, forget the, I don't know about you, but I'd say forget all this liquor. I want to drive in Tim's Corvair.
Yeah. I'm all about a Corvair. Well, I think it's just sad. I suspect that it was I believe it's a federal law, right? Like bribery to vote. I believe it's a federal law. But I suspect they just didn't know any better. Like nobody told them any better.
But they spent some quality money on limos and free bar tabs. Those aren't cheap either, especially with some of the drinkers that I know. Why would anybody running for a little local office that's a part-time job that might pay a couple of $100 a month, why would they shell out that kind of money for votes?
Well, why do we spend almost $1 billion to elect a president? I mean,
yeah, but
I mean, I don't think that the...
You're electing the leader of the free world there.
Right, I mean, but I think it's about power. You know, they think that, you know, this is their, maybe that candidate's stepping stone to, you know, further office. And so they find it very important to win. But it could be over-enthusiastic volunteers. Like, it may not have been the actual candidates that had anything to do with it. It may have been over-anxious volunteers.
Yeah.
Another theory. I think elected officials in Tuscaloosa get free Alabama tickets, and these folks couldn't get them any other way, so they're just going to anything necessary. but that's just my theory. Who knows?
But David, one more question for you. Don't you find it a little bizarre that this kind of money is being spent for the acquisition of an office like that?
I've been to Tuscaloosa once. I don't know why anybody wants to go to those extremes. And another thing, in seriousness, I thought, is if you're talking about college students, there's a good chance you're going to be getting, you know, underage drinking, and that's going to cause a whole nother slew of charges and stuff you don't want to happen. And so that's just another problem that comes along with this whole thing. So, you know, it's just a kind of a bizarre story. You know, it's funny, the stories we've been doing out of Alabama, because the state has been so lopsided with Republicans controlling everything, have been just these quirky kind of crazy stories. And you can't talk horse crazy anymore about Alabama. It's this time not. Or that agriculture candidate, you know, getting cost twice in like a month stealing stuff. And just bizarre things like that. Well, let's do a little national story real quick. People feel that it's the clearest sign that Hillary Clinton is going to run, because Harold Ickes has reasserted himself and got a position on the DNC. I kind of thought she was running anyway. I didn't really need much of a clear sign, but Catherine, is a big clear sign for you?
No. I mean, I think it seems pretty obvious. You know, she's sort of... I mean, I guess that's just further evidence, but I don't think we needed any, you know, further evidence that she was going to run. That seemed like a story, you know, not really a story. It was just like, oh, well,
yeah.
Harold Ickes. Somebody wanted to just remind us that Harold Ickes was on the DNC again, and so this was their way of telling that story.
Yeah.
But you know,
Tim,
I don't think it's any big news to me. But
yeah, big news to you, Tim.
Not really. It just looks to me like a good candidate and a good organization plowing the road and leaving no stone unturned. He had himself appointed to the DNC's rules and bylaws committee. It's a very important committee. They help select strong candidates, and according to some, including Donna Brazile, who would know, it is a sure sign that Hillary Clinton is starting to put her people into places like this, and you know, that's the kind of thing she needs to be doing. And yeah, I'm with you. She is running anyway. Of course, she was.
Yeah, I think so, too. Well, final story it looks like tonight is in Arkansas, like a lot of rural states, the answer to the Newtown shooting was, let's arm some teachers and some administrators. And in Arkansas, there was a state senator that went one step further and wanted to run the gun training courses himself. He shot one of the teachers that was his student. Of course, I probably wouldn't have gone to his course, but if I did, I'd probably say, well, crap, why couldn't I got shot by somebody good like Dick Cheney?
Yeah, really.
But, you know, that's just me. Catherine, how embarrassing is this?
It's very embarrassing. It's ridiculous. And it just, you know, reminds me further of how impressed I am with that woman, I wish I could remember her name, in DeKalb County, who was able to disarm a shooter with no gun whatsoever, but with, you know, the language of passion and peacefulness.
and that's a much better model. Been at this training, she could have told the state senator, come on, sweetie, we don't need to train anybody, and he would have put his gun down and not shot the teacher.
No, but I think it's just a counterpoint to, you know, that there are other ways to solve these problems than having everyone with guns. I mean,
yeah,
it is a funny story, but there's some, you know, there's some legitimate concerns about things like that. Like, of course, people, it's going to happen. Random people are going to get shot if everybody's got guns.
Yeah. I mean, this is just crazy. I mean, this just shows how, you know, volatile a loaded weapon can be, Tim, right?
Yeah, and I say this as a lifetime gun owner from a family of them. I just wonder why anyone thinks that arming school personnel, most of whom I imagine are untrained, is a good idea. And who ever got the idea, and where did they get it, that more guns meant less gun violence? Why did that disconnect ever get there? Guys, I don't understand it.
So you're saying they should follow the Eastman Gun Show model and not have the guns, even at the gun show?
You know what?
You know, I'm never going to get that.
There's certain places you don't have guns, and schools are one of them. They got to be gun-free, though. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Churches, guns, shopping malls, airports, pretty obvious. I'm okay with them being at the gun show, though. Well, this has been the Kudzu Vine for this week. Once again, congratulations to DeBose Porter for his election, and hopefully in the near future we can have him on the show.
That'd be great.
All right, guys. Good night.
Good night. Happy Labor Day. Bye.